It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. I'm going to start with the thing that really set me off today. ProPublica came out with a piece today, said that the super rich, again, we already know this. This is another one of those things where I don't know why I was so ripped off today. I don't know why I was such in a funk as I read through this, because I already know it. We already know that the uber wealthy don't pay their fair share of taxes. We know that the Jeff Bezoses of the world, that the George Soroses of the world, very bipartisan on all sides of the political aisle, they love their tax cuts. They don't pay their taxes. And look, we end up footing the bill. So when ProPublica came out with this piece that said, look, many of the uber rich pay nothing, nothing. There were years that Jeff Bezos paid nothing. There were years that George Soros paid nothing. Good on the list. Elon Musk, there were years, nothing. Richest man in the world, nothing. Paying a lower effective tax rate than the secretary. And again, you know, this is not new. This is what Warren Buffett said years ago. It's class warfare. His class is winning, but they shouldn't be. He identified the reality that he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary does. Something wrong there. Something horribly wrong. And again, we're told, this is one of those things that we're led to believe, that we have this progressive tax code. That the more we earn, the more we pay. The bigger our shoulders, the more water we carry. That kind of analogy. That our tax code is set up in a way that, you know, kind of trying to level the playing field a little bit. We get the things that we need by taxing people who have enormous wealth. And also, part of the reason you have a progressive tax code is so that you don't have a handful of people with such enormous wealth that they can basically buy our government. I guess too late on that front, because we have a billionaire class that is so entitled, so powerful, that they get whatever they want. Now, understand, this is the weird thing for me, and this is kind of where I was focusing my attention as I was remembering back, you know, years ago, you know, because you know, we've been told for a couple of generations now that we need to cut taxes, we need to cut regulation, we need to do all of these things and give all these things to the wealthy because they're smart. You know, they know what to do with money. They're not going to squander it. You know, on things like a $500 million boat, they're not going to squander it on, you know, taking their brother into space. They're not going to do those things. They know what to do with it. And I've always said, yeah, I agree. They do know what to do with it. And they've showed us time and time again that they know what to do with all of the money that we give them. And that is, you can say it, it's quite simple. Make more money for themselves. Not for the general public. You know, there's no trickle down because we were led to believe, and I keep hammering on this because it's important that you remember the history of how we got here, how we got to a situation where you have 600 billionaires vying to get on the Forbes 400. You now need $2 billion plus to get on the Forbes 400. A simple billion won't do it. As we're back in, you know, in the 1980s when the Forbes list started, even in today's dollars, you would have only had three billionaires. So how did that happen? How did we create the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization? How did we do that? Well, simple. We did it by massive redistribution of wealth from the working class. We've stolen wages. We've taken health benefits away. We've decimated retirement security. And of course, we've screwed them over with education and infrastructure and all of the investments that we didn't make in the future of our country, while simultaneously running up a massive debt on the federal level so that we can have a billionaire class that has a couple of pet politicians. That's how we got here. So this is where my mind was today. I'm in this moment of just being ticked off. Not because I'm jealous of someone's wealth, but because there's a sense of fairness. You won the game. This is like, you know, when you win a game and you refuse to shake hands with the people who lost. This is like when you win a game and you basically just taunt the opposing team. This is kind of how it is. Rubbing our face in the fact that we've created the largest billionaire class in the history of civilization, and we still can't get things done. And what's weird to me is, again, we're told that we have this progressive tax code, where the more income you have, the more you pay taxes. The Eisenhower tax code was truly a progressive tax code. It went up a small percentage every $2,000 you earned, all the way until infinity. Or until you got into $1.6 million in today's dollars, which I think back then was about 200 grand. Every $2,000, your taxes went up a little bit, and you paid a little bit higher, a little bit higher, a little bit higher. Because we needed revenue to invest in roads and bridges and schools and hospitals and all that kind of stuff that our grandparents' generation left us. An infrastructure that was the envy of the world. I mean, we've been living off the investments of past generations for decades. This is not new. And it's because we've had to give, you know, our dues dollars to the very wealthy. Now, what I found most just outrageous about this ProPublica piece, because understand, someone anonymously took a whole bunch of rich people's taxes and dumped them at their doors. So they got to go through all this stuff because it's obscene what they found. And what they found is that, you know, the people who paid the most taxes were oddly enough the people who made between $2 and $5 million. They paid about 27.5%. That's the highest group. Now you go above them, it starts to go down. And when you get to that very tippy top place, you know, like the top 25 richest people, their rate's considerably lower, 23%. I mean, it's 15.6%. Anything over $69 million was 23%. Anything above that, our top 25 folks, about 15.6%. And you go, how's that possible? How did we get here? Well, you know, they got lobbyists, lots of them, to fund these kind of things, which is why they're fighting tooth and nail against Biden's, you know, I'll be honest, I wish it was bigger. I wish, like a lot of things, I wish Biden would move us in a much bigger direction and a much larger tax increase. But he's trying to get, what was it, up to 39%? And the Republicans are fighting tooth and nail to say, no, we can't do that because we have to keep the wealthiest people wealthier. They also point out that our richest 25, our top 25, the rare stratified air above of their, they saw their collective wealth from 2014 to 2018 grow by $401 billion. And on that $401 billion windfall, they paid a mighty $13.6 billion tax. Let's do the math on that. That's about 3.4%. That's more than virtually every person who works. And yet we're told we can't do anything about our tax code. It's infuriating. And then when you look at the fact that we don't even audit them as much. In fact, the people that we audit the most are poor people. People with incomes under 25 grand a year. They get audited at a much higher rate than people who have incomes of $500,000. Figure that out. Why? Easy prey. And of course, you know, we want to poor shame. We want to beat people up, make sure they're not cheating at the bottom. Because we know that they don't have lawyers. See, we know the Donald Trumps, and we know the Bill Gates, and we know the people at the top. They've got teams of tax avoidance lawyers. They've got, you know, just entire teams of people who try to figure out how they can pay nothing. And you got people say, well, you know, if we lower the tax rate, they'll then pay the rate. No, they don't want to pay anything. In fact, not only do they not want to pay anything, they want us to pay them. And we've done that. It's quite remarkable. Now, I take this where we've made the wildly wealthy even wealthier. We've given them massive tax breaks. We've given them loopholes, whatever you want, however you want to try and avoid paying taxes. In fact, those of us who work for a living, we're paid, we pay taxes on a whole different scheme than people who invest for a living. If your gig is owning stocks, you pay a lower tax right out of the gate. Something wrong. I then see this story that jumps out at me that says, you know those stimulus checks that we gave out this year? That actually worked to help make people's lives better. There were major declines in people going to bed hungry. There were major declines in financial instability. People's depression and anxiety levels went down. All over, you know, a simple, you know, $2,000. I mean, you got the $600, I guess it was January, the $1,400 in April. And over that period of time, what we found, and it's not surprising, what we found is people took that money and they used it to put food on the table. They used it to keep a roof over their head. They used it to pay medical bills. They didn't go out and have a grand party. They didn't go on vacation. Not like they could, but they didn't. And we've seen this movie before. We've seen communities across the country who have done these studies where they've taken homeless people and they've given them a home and some revenue to and some money to be able to exist. And what they found overwhelmingly is people make the right choices with their dollars. Now, the reason that this is interesting to me, because we have this blind faith belief that the wealthy, they know what to do with money. They're going to use it wisely. They're going to invest it, and they're going to make more money for themselves. Now, along the way, they will buy a $500 million boat or, you know, start a space program so they can take their brother into space, whatever. But they're smart with the money. They're going to know what to do. Now, poor people, no, we can't trust poor people. Can't trust them with actual money, which is why food stamps. Again, we give people food stamps in when I was a kid in clown money. It was like paper clay, you know, kid money. It's clown money. Here's this cartoon dollar. Can I have food, please? Now we do them with little cards. You can only use the card. Instead of saying, you know, you're the best arbiter of what happens in your life, you know, figure out how to get by. We're okay with the rich taking all of the resources, but not the poor. And and I guess this is, you know, the kind of poor shaming that's been going on. And for me, this moment, and I'm looking at this Census Bureau survey that they've done, they're saying, look, you know, this stimulus, it worked. This experiment of a social safety net helped people. Huh, imagine that. I mean, we used to have a social safety net in this country until Republican policy and neoliberal policy came in and shattered it. We used to have the ability to say we don't want people to go hungry. We used to fight against homelessness. We used to make sure that we tried to get veterans a place to stay. I look at the numbers that they came out with. And again, the numbers that this organization brought out was pretty simple. According to this analysis, they said those two payments, the $600 and the $1,400, saw food shortages for families drop by 42% from January to April. Financial instability, they said, fell by 43%. And anxiety and depression and those things fell, they said, by more than 20%. To put it in more real terms, about 5.2 million children didn't go to bed hungry. That's pretty incredible. Now, for me, I'm sitting here and I'm going, hold on. We have this powerful tool, and I've always said we should do this. If the private sector can't and won't create enough jobs to give people the income that they need to survive, the public sector has to. We, the people, have to. And this is an incredible experiment. This is an opportunity to say, you know what? People made good choices. They know what they need. They need food. They need housing. They need clothing. They need medical care. They know what they need. Give them the resources to get them. And it got me thinking, you know, we have this tool. We've got the power. We've got the power to do whatever we want. Collectively, we can solve any problem whatsoever, except we choose not to. And it got me thinking, you know, what if Superman, with all the powers that Superman had, decided that, well, you know what? I want to rob banks instead. I don't want to use my powers for good. I don't want to do the right thing. I just want to rob banks. That's basically what our economy has turned into. You have a bunch of really wealthy people who are just going, you know what? The heck with you guys. More for me. I mean, I look at Jeff Bezos. When I was a kid in the 80s, they used to say, you know, the one who dies with the most toys wins. Bezos has won and he isn't even dead yet. He could buy himself a legacy. He himself could solve a lot of our country's problems. But instead, going to space, going to play on his boat, play with his dinghy. There's something seriously wrong with the way things are. And look, this is why policy is so important. And now what you have are Democrats who are running away from this stuff. You have Democrats who are running away from the social safety net. What I would argue is an incredible achievement. One of the best things that's happened since the 1960s for poor people. The fact that we're again rediscovering what government action, what sound policy, smart investment can do to help society do better. And not just the poor, but the entire working class, because the money that they spend on food and housing and clothing and medical care and all that stuff goes right into the economy and creates more jobs. Instead of just going, you know what, we're going to give Jeff Bezos more money. He can build his boat somewhere over in the Netherlands. Take that $500 million, spend it in a local community and see what happens. We make people's lives better. We make communities better. We have an economy that starts to work for all people instead of just the handful at the top. And for me, in this moment, while you've got Democrats who are running away from the unemployment insurance extension, I mean, even Joe Biden himself said it should, the extra $300 is going to run its course in September. They're not willing to say, no, we want to continue that to make sure that people have opportunity. They're running from it, which I think is the wrong message. The right message is, how do we ensure that families get what they need? And if the private sector won't create the jobs that are going to help us get to that point, the public sector has to force the hand. To me, it is that simple. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, Rick, at therickssmithshow.com. Got a lot to get to, a lot to talk about. Going to take a quick break when we come back. Robert Craig's going to be here to talk a little bit about Ron Johnson and the most recent crazy letter from him. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day the Granite Mountain and Speculator Mines in Butte, Montana, caught fire, killing 168 miners. It is considered the worst underground hard rock mining disaster in the nation's history. Just weeks after the U.S. had entered World War I, the demand for copper had surged. Granite Mountain, like many of the nation's mines, operated around the clock to meet war production needs. In his book, Fire and Brimstone, The North Butte Mining Disaster of 1917, Michael Puntke notes the irony of the disaster, which began as an effort to improve safety. A sprinkler system had just been installed. The final task was the relocation of an electrical cable. The cable was insulated with oil-soaked cloth sheathed in lead. Workers lost control of the 3-ton cable as they lowered it into the mine and it fell to the bottom of the shaft. Carrying a commonly used carbide burning lamp, the night shift foreman accidentally ignited the cable as he planned its removal. The conflagration was virtually immediate and burned for more than 3 days. At the time, 415 miners were at work on the overnight shift. Smoke and gases quickly filled both mines. With no alarm system in place, those that could not escape succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. In 1996, a memorial plaza was dedicated to those who lost their lives. It details a slice of Butte's mining and labor history that culminated in tragedy. The suffering and the pain we remember to this day. The miners, the miners. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it looks like Ron Johnson still hasn't decided if he's going to run for Senate in Wisconsin in 2022. I kind of hope he does, to be honest. There's part of me that would like to see him, like Trump, take a beating and then see him go away in shame. Because, look, at the end of the day, this guy's kind of off his rocker. If you look at the letter that he just signed on to with Cruz and with Lee and with Scott and some of the there were five crazies. You look at this letter and you go, explain to me why it is you think that we're treating the people who attacked our Capitol, wanted to hang our vice president more harshly than anyone else. They're criminals. They deserve to be in jail. But Ron thinks we should treat them with kid gloves. Here to share some thoughts on the good senator from Wisconsin. I've asked one of my favorite Wisconsinites to come share some thoughts. Robert Craig is the executive director of Citizens Action of Wisconsin. Their website, citizenactionwi.org. Robert, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Rick.
So we got your senator penning a letter saying, "Hey, you're treating our people a little too harshly."
Yeah, and you've seen the data. I mean, he's trying to make this, false equivalency between people who tried to commit an insurrection and overwhelm police officers and came there to interrupt a constitutional process, and one of the largest protest movement in American history by the numbers, and overwhelmingly peaceful. The Harvard Radcliffe Institute did a report on this where they looked at all 7,000 plus events that occurred in the Black Lives Matter protests from 2020. And of those, 96.3% involved no property damage or police injuries, and 97.7% of events, no injuries to participants or bystanders or police. These were incredibly peaceful overall. And in fact, the violence that did occur often was from the police, right? Or was from right-wing agitators, or for a small group of left-wing folks who believe in violence as a solution, but it was not this movement. If you're gonna have that many people turning out, find the millions and millions in that many cities and that many events, there's gonna be some stuff that happens, but that is a very different thing than what we saw with this insurrection. But I think the thing to think about, Rick, is you referred to the mental health of our senator from Wisconsin, or potentially, that maybe this is a really good reelection strategy because Trump overperformed because he turned out a whole lot of voters that the pollsters missed. He got 8% more than the polls in Wisconsin were measuring before the election. And maybe Ron Johnson is trying to simply redo that playbook and lean into where Fox News is, Newsmax, the One America Network, and just rev up that base in a midterm election. So maybe he's crafty and not crazy.
No, that's an excellent point. But at the end of it, regardless if he's crazy or crafty, still selling out our democracy for his own gain.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And he's been an ideological extremist since he got elected. Some never Trumpers very much promoted him at the time. People who have tried to learn from their mistakes. People like Charlie Sykes, who's now all over MSNBC, was regularly promoting Ron Johnson early in his career. He upset Russ Feingold. And he had the two perfect elections because Feingold, there was a rerun election, 2010 and 2016. What could be two worse years to run for U.S. Senate as a Democrat in Wisconsin? But he's gone a beeline to even more extreme right, really, in many ways, the most loyal Trumpy in the Senate. The others are. And in fact, what's been odd about his performances, whereas Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz were shameless before the insurrection, they backed off a bit and tried to look at senators in the hearings. It was Ron Johnson throwing out the red meat, saying that maybe the protesters were Antifa and not really from the right. Now, apparently, they're victimized and are being harassed by the Department of Justice per the letter, right? So it's hard to know which one is which. And about his fear, how he would have been if he wasn't afraid of them because they were God-fearing Americans, I guess, because he thought they were conservative and predominantly white. But then he would have been terrified it was Black Lives Matter protesters. And everyone went after the racism and the mainstream media for that, Rick. But I think even more significant is the assumption that the Black Lives Matter movement ever plotted anything like an insurrection, right? And so that equivalency is gross as well, not just the obvious racism, being afraid of a multiracial movement and not being afraid of white supremacists, basically, who are trying to violently overthrow the country by preventing the certification of an election of an American president.
Right. And, but here's the thing. On January 6th, I was reading the Parler accounts of the people there. I was reading the social media of the people who were planning to attend what they believed was an opportunity to stop a presidential election from being certified and overturning that election and reinstalling Donald Trump as the president. This was not a, oh, we're going to have our voices heard. We're not going to, this isn't, we're just taking our grievances for redress. No, this, they went with the specific goal of stopping the certification of that election.
And by force. And they really put together some real gallows, not fake. And they were really after Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi and anyone else they get their hands on, like members of the squad, like AOC. And it's very lucky they didn't get a hold of anyone, actually. It was a close call. It's actually, and this is why there needs to be a bipartisan commission, Rick, a real one, is hard to believe that there was not a stand down order coming from the Department of Defense and from Homeland Security, because you know, they just left the ill-prepared Capitol Police without intelligence, without backup for hours and hours.
Yeah.
It's just very suspicious. So we really need to get to the bottom of that. They're clearly Trump called for them to do it, called them to Washington, changed the date of the event to be on the certification day. It was supposed to actually come much later. And then also, you know, directed them over there. There's no question about the whole thing. And but there's still a lot we don't know about how this happened. But as you know, in coups around the world, one of the oldest tricks in the book is to stand down the defense system, right? So that you can go in and do your business, so to speak, by disrupting a constitutional government and taking power.
No, which is why, again, I come back to we do need to have a full, open, and transparent investigation. And I'll be honest, I think Ron Johnson and the Republicans filibustering the bipartisan commission was probably a good thing in my view. Because I'm hoping the Democrats take this moment and say, we're going to set up select committees and we are going to investigate the hell out of this for as long as it takes. If it takes, you know, the next 10 years to do this, that's what it's going to take. My problem with the commission is they set an end date for the end of the year. I don't know that you get that kind of work done in that short a period of time. But the Republicans did us a favor and said, go ahead, investigate until the cows come home.
And apparently shocked Joe Manchin, according to press reports. He's very flabbergasted that we didn't get bipartisan cooperation, which is bizarre. That's partly why we have a problem with him. But I think you're right that this was going to be a lame, watered-down commission, and now let's do a Benghazi-style commission with something really to investigate, not a trumped-up charge, political charge. And they don't want that information to come out, and they have a lot to hide, I think. I think that's what Mitch McConnell knows. He has a lot to hide. But I'd also say, since we're held up by the filibuster now and by two Democrat senators, I think maybe we have an independent party of four senators that also include Murkowski and Collins. And they actually, their criterion is bipartisanship, which is impossible if you're going to do constructive legislation. But Ron Johnson could win re-election. We have a really strong primary, a lot of candidates running. It'll be a big money primary because there's so much interest in taking him on. But this is a very closely divided state, an off-year election where you can rev up that base all over the state of people who are revved up and made rabid with hatred every night by Fox News, which has gone far right to fend off the threat from farther right media, upstart media sources, that there's this is going to be a really hard, a $30 million race, and Ron Johnson could be reelected. So, you know, here in Wisconsin, we're really focused on reelecting the governor, because otherwise they're going to set it up so the legislature can steal the 2024 election and name the electors if they have a Republican legislature and a Scott Walker-like Republican governor. And then, of course, control of the Senate is absolutely critical, and we really need to pick up Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, in my mind, are the two top seats we have to flip in 2022.
Now, it'd be nice to pick up Ohio and North Carolina as well, yeah. But you're right. Wisconsin and Pennsylvania are the two must-get seats so that we can at least hold on to the Senate and maybe undo some of the damage from Sinema and Manchin. But here's the thing. I mean, I hear what you're saying about revving up the base. Isn't this kind of denial something that would rev up the Democratic base and just being incredulous to the fact that they saw with their own eyes what happened on January 6th and they're represented by someone who says, oh, no, it wasn't a big deal. It wasn't an armed thing. It wasn't an insurrection. It was just people who were coming to come to their capital.
We can absolutely rev up the white progressive base. I think we continue to eat into the Milwaukee suburbs, which are beginning to become very purple, which is very problematic for Republicans in the state. That used to be Scott Walker's heartland, right? We're beginning to win assembly seats, Senate seats there, and it's beginning to change. But I think you really have to, even though our person of color community is small and concentrated in the Milwaukee area, that do we have accomplishments to make young African-Americans and people and Latinx folks feel like they have a stake in this election? Because they have so little opportunity that they need some sort of positive notion that we can have, you know, we can change the policing system, we can create real jobs for people that they can actually get a hold of and make a career on and raise a family on. And I'm not sure just the fear of how bad Ron Johnson is enough. And so in a razor thin election, I think Manchin and Sinema are a real challenge here because they're going to limit the constructive accomplishments Biden can show unless we can get through this mess we have right now where with this insistence that we create 10 Republican votes for constructive legislation, which is impossible with this neo-fascist Republican Party.
Yeah, no, and I wanted to talk about that for a second because, you know, if nothing more gets done, if we can get no legislation moved through, we don't get a big infrastructure bill that's going to create jobs and help rebuild the Rust Belt cities like Milwaukee and states like Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania and Michigan, I fear it's a slaughter in 2022, and Republicans understand this, which is why I go back to Joe Manchin's insistence that we do this bipartisan thing that is really a fantasy, given the realities of the last 20 years. I think the cards are already dealt and the future's already set if nothing gets accomplished.
Yeah, it's as mythical as the Gone with Wind view of the antebellum South, all the happy times, right, and the happy slaves that are part of the family, enslaved people. And so this idea that the filibuster is some kind of key institution of the Senate that creates a deliberative body, that if it's anything other than a Jim Crow-treated institution, out of a rule, by the way, that was supposed to end filibusters. That rule was distorted by Richard B. Russell and the Jim Crow senators. And that just this notion that it's the responsibility of Biden and Schumer and the Democrats to find 10 Republicans where it's their interest to undermine this administration no matter what, because all they really want is power, period. So the only votes on the table, possibly, are the two members of this bipartisan party. That would be Murkowski and Collins. And even then, they're not a give me on anything, any bold legislation. So we got to figure out, I'm glad we get the American Rescue Plan and there was a lot there. I'm glad we're going to hopefully have, you know, a herd immunity for COVID-19, you know, and a vaccination rate that is great enough. The herd immunity may be a myth, but that to actually make it safer and then an attempt to vaccinate the world. But everything else we have to figure out, unless we can break this logjam, how to promise that would be the outcome of winning the 2022 election. And that means making a clear public case as to who blocked this.
No, I'm with you on that because I don't see 10 Republicans who are going to come around. But what do you say, Robert, who the people go, well, you know, Democrats use the filibuster too to stop Republicans. This isn't just Republicans stopping Democrats. And if you do away with the filibuster, well, bad things are going to happen. And you could see the end of Social Security. You could see the end of Medicare. You could see the end of collective bargaining rights. All this bad stuff could happen when Republicans become the ones in power. What do you say to those folks?
Kind of a false narrative of the filibuster. You know, between Reconstruction and 1964, the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the only bills filibustered and killed were civil rights bills. So this was created for that purpose. And it started to expand in use in the 90s and the early aughts, but it has been supercharged by Mitch McConnell. This is a relatively modern Republican strategy to have a 60-vote threshold for every piece of legislation. And with the loopholes they've created for federal judges, remember they minted Trump judges and Supreme Court justices, and of course with budget reconciliation, which allows you to give the Trump tax cut, the largest tax cut in history for corporations and the well-connected and wealthy, they don't need to use regular legislation to get what they want, because they don't want broad constructive legislation, new social legislation, action on climate or racial equity, et cetera. So we have a filibuster that's aligned, that's racially biased and structurally racist and aligned with against Democratic priorities. So you have the shocking position that Senate doesn't have the power to raise the minimum wage for working people, but does to give whatever tax cuts it wants to corporate America. And so, I mean, really, it has become simply so commonplace with this, with Mitch McConnell, that it's nothing like it's ever been, even in its worst periods. It was only applied horribly to civil rights. Now it's applied to absolutely everything to undermine the Democratic president. And you have two Democratic, quote unquote, Democratic co-conspirators. But we knew it was going to be harder with 50 vote Senate, but they're making it harder and harder. The only hope I see out there is my counterpart in West Virginia, who runs West Virginia Citizen Action, who's worked with Manchin since he first got elected and ran for office, says you really shouldn't believe anything he says about what his bottom line is or what he's actually thinking. And so there's some hope that they can keep working this through and get some major constructive legislation through Manchin. I think that's the only course, but it's looking more and more dire.
Yeah, no, I've known that about Manchin as well. What he projects is one thing. What he's going to do is always something else. But he seems to be really dug in, and the more people are pushing, the more he's digging in. And that to me is concerning, because, look, we got to get something done on voting rights, or 2022, it's over, because states have already set up the way that they're going to do all of the things that Trump wanted to do in 20. That's a bad place to be in.
When you think about the narrative, Rick, I mean, right now it looks like, okay, Democrats are blocking it. But not many people follow the filibuster. Average working people are too busy keeping their heads above water and supporting their families. And so that's why I think Schumer's going to start having votes and trying to make it very clear who's voting no.
No, I hope that's the way forward. But Robert, I appreciate your time, your thoughts, your expertise. Always great talking with you. I look forward to talking to you again real soon.
Always a pleasure, Rick. Keep on keeping on.
Good stuff. Our good friend Robert Craig, he is the executive director of Citizen Action of Wisconsin. Make sure you check out their website, citizenactionwi.org. We'll get links out in social media. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1904. That was the day that John Carley, a union miner, was shot down in Dunnville, Colorado. Carley was part of a strike in the Cripple Creek gold mining region. The miners had gone out on strike in support of workers at the Standard Mill in Colorado City, which processed the mined ore. Colorado Governor Peabody was determined to break the strike. He called in the state militia, who joined forces with company army gun thugs, with 1,000 rifles and 60,000 rounds of ammunition to back them up. General Sherman Bell, a veteran of Teddy Roosevelt's Rough Rider Squad in the Spanish-American War, led the National Guard. During the strike, one of General Bell's deputies is said to have declared, "To hell with the Constitution! We aren't going by the Constitution." This pretty much summed up General Bell's approach to the conflict. The militia began to round up Union miners. More than 1,500 miners were captured and given a so-called trial by the militia. 238 of these miners were then deported from the region. They were shipped by train to Denver, Kansas, and New Mexico, and warned not to return. The militia learned of a group of pro-Union workers at a small encampment known as Dunnville. General Bell loaded up more than 100 militiamen and company deputies on a train and headed for the camp. There they exchanged gunfire with the miners. 65 miners, armed with just 10 guns among them, had little chance against the well-armed company men. John Carley was killed, and 14 miners were arrested. The union was crushed in the sights of 1,000 guns. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So some good news today out of the Senate. I know it's easy to complain about the Senate, and I have done a lot of that. But maybe there are issues, a handful, one or two, that we can find some bipartisan support on. And look, I think China's got to be one of those. I think given the realities of coming out of this pandemic, realizing that we've given away our manufacturing base and we can no longer support ourselves, I think it's gotten some folks awakened, which is why today we saw the vote. What was it? 68-32 was the vote. You got 19 Republicans to come along with the Democrats, including Mitch McConnell. Pretty impressive. On the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, for me, the biggest part of it all was that eight Republicans voted not to strip prevailing wage from this legislation. To me, that's a big, that's enormous. I kind of think they don't know what it is. Just my thought. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the passage of the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. It is great to be with you. And just so your audience knows, there's a little thunder and lightning. So might add a little spice to the conversation.
As long as you don't get struck, we're good. So what do you think of this? Let's start with the first part, the part that took me. Texas Senator Cornyn, he put forth an amendment to strip prevailing wage out of this legislation so that the jobs that'd be created could be poverty wage jobs. And you got eight Republicans to vote against that. I find that shocking.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rick, you remember, I guess 20 years ago, that there were a few pro-labor Republican senators.
Yeah, that was 20 years ago, Scott.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. It was a while ago. And so that number, I'll candidly admit, is a bit of a surprise. You know, they, you know, when the rubber hits the road and there's a vote, you know, that would come to get this into law, would they vote the same way? I don't know. Maybe they know that there's a long process that lies ahead. This legislation has to go through the House of Representatives. So we will see. I do think part of that, and we could have a whole separate conversation about this, is that these Republican attempts to make inroads to the working class, I've always said, yeah, you can talk about trade or China, you can do that, but you also have to be for family leave, you have to be for the minimum wage increasing to a living wage. You have to be for provisions like David, and you have to be for things like the right to organize and the PRO Act if you're really going to be pro-labor. So a few of them, obviously, were able to check this box, but there's still a long way to go. That said, the fact that there was a bipartisan vote on anything, is really shocking, and as an industrial policy advocate, really amazing to see, and hopeful and promising.
No, you're absolutely right. And you start, but here's where my mind goes. You go, look, you know, our auto industries, you know, was shut down for a while because we didn't have the semiconductors that we need to do things. We don't have critical components. So I look at the Republican Party as, and you can disagree, and that's okay, as wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, along with a good portion of the Democrats. So when corporate America is saying, hey, we need something, it's not surprising that the Republicans come and help get that. And they're talking about, $50 billion over the next 5 years to subsidize only semiconductor manufacturing. Yeah. That tells me that they know that this is a major shortfall in our economy.
Well, 100%. And you think of all the industries. I'm just looking around your studio and how many semiconductors there must be just there alone. I mean, we all depend on them in everything. And the automotive sector, telecommunications, even things like fitness equipment. I mean, there's a lot of semiconductors out there. It's an important part of our digital economy and technology. And so, you know, $50 billion sounds like a lot of money. I'm going to say, you know, obviously, I think some Republicans like this because there was a lot in it for big businesses. But there was also a lot in this for working people as well. And that's something that distinguishes this piece of legislation. You know, it's not perfect, but it's not like businesses get ahead and workers get left behind in this. That's simply not the case. And so I do think there's some sense that if we are going to successfully compete with the Chinese government in the future, that we got to be in this together, speaking with one voice. And at least for one day, the Senate was able to do that. But semiconductors are the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's a lot of other serious manufacturing challenges out there, both from a policy perspective. You look at trade policy, which this bill really didn't touch. And you look at things like that. And then you also look at the range of industries that are impacted, from commodity industries like steel and aluminum to semiconductors and everything in between. So this may sound like a major investment, but we are playing a lot of catch up here, just like we are on issues like infrastructure investment. This will allow us to be successful. This doesn't guarantee us to be number one
right.
in the future. It's going to take a lot of hard work to get there, but at least we're not sitting on the sidelines anymore.
No, this is something we have talked about for a very long time. China's been planning the next generation of jobs going to them in aerospace and pharmaceuticals and robotics and 5G technology and all of these things that we've kind of just, well, ceded to them. It's not even like we were competing, because we were sending our jobs over there. Corporate America saw China as the future. The Chamber of Commerce was the main pipeline to shipping jobs overseas, because shareholders were making tons of money. And it's this pandemic, I think, at least I believe, that's kind of shaken us awake and gone, or at least some of us. I've always been against this, but some of us have gone, you know, We're and I hate to use this word, but we're at war, and we've been at war for a very long time. Only we didn't realize it.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I know you and I agree, and so your listeners know, we're talking about the Chinese government here. We're not talking about Asians. We're not talking about Asian Americans. We're not talking about Chinese. We're talking about the actions of the Chinese government. And not only do they oppress their own citizens who do not agree with them, and also ethnic minorities, but they have this range of economic policies that allow their firms to get ahead at the expense of everybody else. And that's the problem with their policies. And we've seen tens of thousands of manufacturing facilities close down in the United States over the last 2.5 decades. We've seen millions of manufacturing workers lose their very middle class benefits. And we've also seen, you know, the vulnerabilities that cost us as a society. You know, during the pandemic, we couldn't supply our own PPE. We are running out of semiconductors. In fact, we're flat out. We've got to build more plants to make that happen. And we're behind in the race for electric vehicles. And so what I like about the Senate bill, and also I think what the administration has been doing, is they understand that you have to cross some lines here. In the past, the U.S. government was never willing to do anything that would have violated the World Trade Organization commitments that we made, or some tenet of free trade. But the Senate bill, for instance, has incentives for electric vehicles, if consumers buy them, with an important caveat: they have to be made in America. That was something that Obama was unwilling to do in the Cash for Clunkers program, if you'll remember, back in 2009. There was Cash for Clunkers existed, and people took advantage of it, but there was absolutely no requirement that those vehicles had to be made in America. And so the Senate bill, it has it in there, and it got a huge amount of support. And so I'm thrilled to see us making policy advances like this, because it's going to be beneficial, obviously, to our security, but also to job creation in the manufacturing sector.
No, and on that war front, because a lot of people want to shy away from it, especially my lefty friends who say, no, we can be friends with the Chinese communist government. And maybe we can, but not on this line, because you know, on this war front, we're seeing the Chinese government becoming much more aggressive. We're seeing the rhetoric coming out of the Chinese state media, much more aggressive. They want to start, you know, competing on the nuclear level with us. And yet we don't make those things. In fact, you guys did the most comprehensive report that I've seen on our dependency on the Chinese with regard to our military that anybody's done. And that was, what, 10 years ago? It should have been wake up call then. Here we are now, all these years later. It's only gotten worse.
Yeah, it sure has. And you can expand that list. And it was a big 350-page report. And people read it, but they never took action. I do see the Senate taking action. You know, the White House released a supply chain review earlier in the day that touched on a number of these issues in key areas like lithium-ion batteries and semiconductors and pharmaceutical active ingredients and rare earth minerals that are in every technological device that we have, but which we have a hard time acquiring. And so I think there is awareness, and I completely agree with you. I mean, the Chinese Communist Party does not want to be friends with the United States. We should be clear about that right away. And we had about two decades where people believed, you know, if only we trade more with China, it will become more democratic. And there's absolutely nothing in the experience with the Chinese Communist Party which would suggest that, even though that was like what all the elites, all the pundits were saying. That is demonstrably false. That is simply not the case. Now, I don't think we want to go out and seek a shooting war with China. We do not want to do that. We want to avoid that. But we certainly need to defend our own interests, our own values, democracy, our economic well-being, and our middle class. And that's going to involve some tough decisions. Some of those are about investing here at home, which the Senate has acted on and the Biden administration is suggesting as well. And some of that is standing up to these unfair trade practices. Trump started it. He did it kind of wildly and unilaterally and inelegantly. But I think that, you know, Biden can build on that, can make it much more strategic, can engage our allies in that as well to make it a more successful effort.
Do you see this going forward as something that both parties in a nonpartisan way will continue to understand? And because, you look, I'm pretty shocked in a way that the Republicans came along, because they're the ones who believe in the free market. They're the ones who don't believe in any government intervention into the markets. Yet here they are. We've seen some movement to saying, yes, government does have a role in this and government should play into this, which is kind of a departure from their ideology. Do you see that going forward possibly?
Yeah, I do. And obviously, you know, about half of them still feel that way, right? You know, about half of the Senate Republicans kind of still feel that way, that we shouldn't be doing this or that. But half of them have on the other side. And I do think it's this sense of urgency and desperation that you have to divorce yourself from philosophy when you see that philosophy failing.
Right.
And you have to be willing to be pragmatic and to try different things. And the stakes are too high, because if we get behind China on all of this, it does threaten our economy and it does threaten our security. And that's I think that's a wake up call. And so there may be many different reasons for doing what the Senate is doing and what we hope the House of Representatives will follow through on as well. But we're happy, I mean, that it's bipartisan. I can't imagine anybody thought the Senate would do anything bipartisan this year of substance. And yet, I'll give credit to Senator Schumer. He stuck with it. He stuck with this process. The bill is not perfect. There is stuff that I'd like to get out of there, Rick, you know, just like everybody else, and hopefully we can. But to their credit, you know, I think Republican senators like Todd Young, John Cornyn were willing to see this through. And so it does strike me that this is one of those rare bipartisan moments, and that there's a lot of support for advancing American interests, and in particular, revitalizing manufacturing.
No, and that's, again, that's something that the Biden administration has, you know, Joe Biden's been talking about for a while. Yeah, and one of those commitments that as a country we should be making, because, you know, I go back to that war frame. The reason, I was told we won World War II is because we had the capacity to change our industrial might and make it a war production machine. We don't have that same kind of production capacity. And this is a different war front. Semiconductors being on that war front. Cyber security being on that war front, the technology, the 5G technology that we're so far behind on, for me, this is that ramping up to protect ourselves from those attacks.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, obviously, that type of security concern is going to look a lot different than it did a generation ago. But we are, and part of this is because we just simply, we had this mantra for so long, not you and I, but the MBAs, the ruling class, all of this, that you can design it here, you can make it somewhere cheap, and everybody will be better off. Well, we know that's not the case. Yes, shareholders are better off, but the working class is certainly not, and our security has suffered. And so as we're trying to engage in these industries of the future, we're actually having to borrow know-how, ideas, capital from overseas to do it because we fell behind on things like lithium-ion batteries or wind power or solar power. And to Joe Biden's great credit, he wants to have it be homegrown. And I'm 100% in favor of that. And it may take a tiny bit longer than environmentalists want, but at the end of the day, it's going to be worth it because it means we're doing something about the climate, we're doing something about security, and we're doing something about American jobs and rebuilding the middle class, which I think ultimately will build more political support for the goal of having a more renewable energy future in the United States.
Yeah, it's something we need. Last question I've got for you. You said, you know, it's got to go through the House. The Democrats control the House. What are the chances that this gets shot down in the House?
Well, look, I do think that there will be a competition package. I don't know when the Speaker will schedule it. I will say I've known Nancy Pelosi since the late 1980s, and she's been concerned about China and human rights and economic practices in China for a very long time. I remember being on the floor of the House of Representatives. I was working for the House Democratic Whip, David Bonner, at the time, and Nancy Pelosi gave one of the closing speeches against normalizing trade relations with China back in 2000, which looked like a really wise decision, more than 20 years later. And so she's got a personal interest in this, and I think there's wide support in the caucus for doing something about it as well.
Yeah, we need to get something done. Like you said, it's not perfect, but it's a start. We need to be investing in our domestic capacity to build research and development and manufacturing without question. But Scott, I appreciate the time. I appreciate your information. As always, good stuff, my friend.
You bet, Rick. Keep it up.
All right, good stuff. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, Alliance for AmericanManufacturing.org. We'll get links out on social media. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We are.